Podcast. My name is Sam Snelling. We are here for a brand new, brand spanking new episode of Dive Cuts, where we are here to talk about your favorite ranked basketball team, the Missouri Tigers. With me, as always, is one Matthew J. Harris. Matt, how are you?
I'm well. I'm here to get outraged about either Jeremiah Tillman not being Player of the Week or Jesse Newell's continued hatred of the Tigers. I don't know what's going to get me more...
Jesse Newell!
I don't know what's going to leave me more enraged. Frankly, I'm ready to burn it all down. Ready to just, you know, tear into everyone here. But I'm fine otherwise, aside from Missouri being robbed of its rightful extra points in the AP poll and Jeremiah Tillman not getting an accolade he'll forget in 5 years. So,
well, I do sort of think, like, I mean, there's a reasonable argument that Jeremiah Tillman had a better week than Colin Castleton. Yeah, they even played the same position.
I'm not disagreeing with that. It's hard for me to get my hackles up over it.
Yeah, it's also another one of those things where Missouri has had several Player of the Weeks, and at some point, like, yeah, I mean, you got to kick that around the league a little bit, right?
Yeah, the SEC's those awards were not created to honor pure, unfiltered excellence. They are a marketing tool, and to see people. I think this is where if you're in a Twitter bubble, you see more of it. But I don't think the average fan's all that outraged. But the folks that I did see were kind of like, "Oh, what is Colin Castleton doing winning?" I'm like, "Okay, Florida's SID just got something he can put in the game notes for this weekend." That's about as that's the implication of that award is that some SID in Gainesville's like. Oh, gotta update the game notes for Wednesday, so and Saturday, gotta get that in. So that 40 minutes of people being like, "Oh, this is curious," was just that their curiosity was curious to me.
Well, we could talk about some of the Newell stuff later, but I feel like it's better if we kind of kick this off by talking about the week that was. Last time we spoke, we were previewing the Auburn basketball game and kind of celebrating the Tennessee win, and we kind of glossed over a little bit of the TCU win because TCU was not really expected to be all that tough of an opponent for Missouri, and turns out that our Fair Tigers needed a come from behind. They were down 12 with 4:40 to play. And willed that all the way down to tie it, send it to overtime, and then they won in overtime. As far as the Auburn game, do you have a lot of deep thoughts? I feel like they just got free throwed to death. I'm one of those kinds of people that I really don't like being critical of officials. I thought that was a pretty horrifically officiated game. I think you always expect the officials to be bad, but I do think that was an especially poorly called basketball game. But at the same time, if you wanted to kind of zoom out, I mean, you lost by 6 on the road at a really tough place to play against a team that, let's face it, has kind of given Missouri a lot of trouble over the years for their style of play, and a team that is certainly, you know, with Sharif Cooper, if they hadn't already taken the postseason ban, I think is squarely a team that would find themselves on the bubble, you know, here probably within a few weeks.
Yeah, first of all, this was the scenario I was talking about last week where I thought Cooper's ability on the ball and his ability to, you know, get a first step and get downhill and get his feet into the paint was something that could go really wrong. And what we've seen from Cruz that cycled through the SEC, if we're going to kind of merge your point on officiating, if you play downhill in this conference, the officials who typically work it as part of their circuit are likely going to blow the whistle. It's guys, you know, crews that are working the upper Midwest and, you know, the Horizon League and the MAC and the Big Ten, you know, those officiating crews just tend to let things get a little bit more physical in and around the rim. They tend to let there be a little bit more hand checking. Not so much crews that are working, you know, the southern part of the country. And also it depends on, you know, the lead official you get some nights. So not surprised that it could go that way. Disappointed that just because I hate the active whistle because because while it creates a free throw advantage, I think it also takes teams out of a rhythm for you offensively. And so there could be trade-offs there from efficiency. But when the foul count gets that high, it's sort of moot. You're going to get enough cracks that a decent free throw shooting team's going to make the numbers and make the math work out. But to your larger point as well, this is just a bad matchup for Missouri. The last four times they've played them, I think three out of four times they've allowed more than 1.05 points per possession. Missouri beat them last year, but Auburn came into Columbia and racked up 46 free throws.
Yeah.
This Missouri team.
And that was without Isaac
Okoro. That was without Okoro. The one thing that people tend to forget is the last two iterations of Konzo Martin's teams have been, I think, worse than 200 nationally in free throw opponents' free throw rate. They get handsy. Missouri is a defensive team that wants to put it, you know, prides itself on that, but they tend to foul a little bit. And when you've got a guy like Cooper who's going to drive the ball and who's being assertive, and you've got Cruz who typically work the league and are deferential to drivers and guys who put the onus on the defense, you can have that sort of happen. And to your final point, Missouri had chances. They had 38 shots around the rim. Went 16 for 38 in the paint. Jeremiah Tillman went 3-11 at the line. There were still opportunities for this team to win this game on the road. The officiating can't be entirely discounted, but Missouri had its opportunities as well. And if you don't take advantage of those opportunities, a night where a team shoots 44 free throws is going to put a win in its column. So not entirely.
Particularly when the bulk of those free throws are going to. And like this is sort of, you know, one of the things that, you know, people have maybe noted about Missouri's free throw shooting has fallen off. You know, a lot of team free throw shooting is about who's shooting free throws. So for Auburn, shooting a lot of free throws, that's great when it's Sharif Cooper. Yeah. And for Missouri, it's great when it's Xavier Pinson and Drew Smith. Those guys make free throws. But when it's Jeremiah Tillman, even when it's Tillman on a good night, Tillman on a good night is a 65%. Yeah, like he's not making, you know, 18 of 23. Like, obviously, he struggled. He was 3 of 11 against Auburn. And he's kind of been on a little bit of a stretch here where, you know, he's regressing a bit. You know, but so much of free throw shooting is who is shooting your free throws. And Missouri sent, however you want to say those calls went. But, you know, Cooper shot a lot of free throws. And what was his?
He went 18 of 21.
He 18 of 21. He shot 21 free throws. So, and Missouri shot 27 free throws. You know, Drew Smith was 8 for 8. Mark Smith was 2 for 2. Kobe Brown was 2 for 2. Xavier Pinson was 3 for 4. But Jeremiah Tillman was 3 of 11. Well, you know, and
my point. If Jeremiah Tillman hits 4 more free throws, goes 7 of 11 at the line, and Missouri converts 2 more layups, it's a 2-point win.
Right.
So it's infuriating as it might be, and I get fan frustration. Believe me, there were people after the game who were telling me I was making excuses for the official. My point is, two things can be true. One, the refs were happy with the whistle. Two, Missouri had, but also Missouri had plenty of opportunities itself inside the painted area to convert. Missouri's a 55 or 60% shooting team typically inside the paint. Even if they're 19 of 38 that night, it's a tie ball game. So
yeah,
there's
just think about like something as simple as like, you know, Tillman wide open dunk opportunity, just bangs it off the back rim.
Yeah. So you finish two plays and you hit a couple more free throws. You know, it's what we're doing last year in Columbia when we talk about tough game, got a good win stylistically, not a good matchup. So tough game, but it's going to be a quad one loss. We saw the brackets afterwards. It didn't do anything to Missouri's seeding.
Yeah. They didn't budge.
They didn't move.
That's the, like another thing that I always like to bring up is the number of people sort of, you know, freak out about what one loss might mean. Like, there's so many other things in motion in college basketball. Like, if Missouri goes on a four-game losing streak, yeah, you want to be concerned at that point. But losing one game here and there in a area of their schedule where you really didn't expect them to maybe win that game at the beginning of the season.
It was a loss.
Yeah, you know, maybe. Yeah, like, I think... I can't remember if I had it as a win or a loss, to be honest. I thought that was an opportunity for them to kind of capture a win that maybe you didn't expect them, you know, because I didn't think Auburn was going to be as good as they've been in recent years. You know, we didn't know how many fans were going to be in attendance. And sure enough, like, that game was competitive. And really, you know, without Cooper in the game, I mean, Missouri was able to control that game just incredibly. So it just kind of shows you how valuable Sharif Cooper is. But kind of moving on, the TCU matchup, you know, we did gloss over it. And, you know, here's the team, and I really, like, they haven't kind of put it all together this year. But it is a team that has, at least if you go by recruiting rankings, like, it has some talent on the roster. And there's some guys who... You know, I think like PJ Fuller, who was like a, you know, a four-star recruit, played with Michael Porter Jr., John Tay up in Seattle, Nathan Hale. I think Missouri even kind of checked in with him at one point, but ends up going to TCU. Chuck O'Bannon is Charles O'Bannon's kid.
Jaden Ledeuk was in
played Ohio, UCLA and like
was
the
Ohio State transfer.
Yeah, I mean,
Eddie Lampkin was a borderline four-star guy.
Like they have talent, and Mike Miles. Even like he was like a top 150 kid. I mean, he's sort of broken out a little bit more than I think you expect him to. But Nemhard was a high 3-star kid. So their roster had some talent. They just haven't
played.
They've struggled to make shots, and I mean, much to Missouri's chagrin. I think I messaged you at one point, you know, like we should have known when I think O'Bannon was the guy that banked in some like 18-foot jumper. So we should have known at that point that it was going to be a weird night offensively. And it was. And, you know, like I am kind of a believer that, that weird things happen. And I've said all along that this year of all years, like, there are going to be a lot more weird things that happen. And so TCU lighting you up for like 98 points in 78 possessions, like, that's not expected. But if you can find a way to win the games where those weird things happen, then you're going to end up ahead of the game. And I think for all the things that didn't go Missouri's way in this really weird game where TCU was playing out of their minds offensively and making a lot of shots that they don't normally make, I mean, yeah, it doesn't look great on the resume to sort of squeak by a team that's barely in the top 100 in KenPom. But, you know, at the end of the day, a win is a win is a win.
I tweeted this afterwards, and it's an obvious point, but I think one people were heartened to see was, you know, they are 6 minutes away from being 9-5, and they're two halves of basketball away from being 13-1, and everything kind of works out. You got to toss everything into the pot of stew there, and you're 11-3. Mizzou fans by nature, and it's obvious, are going to really harp on those five quad one wins they own. But really, if you don't, it's easy to say, oh, that they had one bad half at Auburn. They had Mississippi State. Yeah, they had one bad half at Mississippi State. Sharif, everything kind of goes into it, and this is something where I look at Missouri, and I've said this. This is a team that is capable of picking off Illinois, but it's also certainly capable of losing to TCU. It just, the offense is bulky enough that it can get itself into binds and can get out over its skis, but it can also get out over its skis like it did. Xavier Pinson going 8-13 from deep. That's over his skis a little bit, just as much as, you know, TCU getting the kind of bench production it did. It was a day where both sides had outlier performances. You know, this is Missouri's one of its best performances under Martin, probably one of its top five offensive performances, also one of its top three worst defensive performances with him here. And it happened at the same time. The one thing that did give me pause was when I was going back through and just looking at the past couple of games is, I think three out of the last four games they've allowed greater than 1.07 points per possession, basically 107 points per 100 possessions. That's problematic, but then do you ask yourself, is it something that's, you know, personnel based? Or is it scheme based? Have teams figured out how Missouri wants to guard, and they've now figured out Missouri's personnel, and now they are, I've seen anecdotally, I haven't gone back and like diagrammed this or plotted it or charted it. Just seems like teams are doing more to target switches and get on to favorable switches, which isn't a new thing. Lots of teams do that. I mean, it's trickled down the professional ranks to here, but is that happening in Missouri? Or is it a function of they've played Mississippi State with two guards who are absolutely sensational in the mid-range, are comfortable shooting those shots, when those shots are what Missouri would consider a shot they want to allow? Missouri is fine forcing a contested two. DJ Stewart and Iverson Molinar are fine taking contested twos and can knock them down. Was that a function of personnel in that game? At Auburn, Sharif Cooper's probably, you know, depending on where we see mock drafts get updated, if he continues on this here, he's going to be a lottery pick. So did a lottery pick who's an elite on-ball creator just have a night against you? And again, in this game, Mike Miles and Arjun Nimbard, both fantastic playing out of ball screens. We kind of knew both could do that a little bit, Miles more than Nimbard, and they got that and they started targeting some switches. So is it a function of they've run into three or four teams where there's a point guard and a combo guard who excel in those situations? Or is it more structural? Are they going to, and where we're really starting to see teams now, kind of like we did earlier in the year, get the drop on this group, and they're going to have to adjust and make some tweaks? I don't know. I just think it's something worth monitoring. So the question to me is TCU an outlier based on the personnel they had on the floor that day and, you know, just fluky shooting performances, or is it a canary in the coal mine? I don't know, but I think it's something to at least broach coming out of that game.
Well, one thing that Konza Martin had his radio show earlier tonight, we're recording this Monday evening, and he did kind of note that as a way to kind of prevent, you know, Jeremiah Tillman from, you know, running into potential foul issues, is they've really kind of gone away from, you know, their tendency of running and trapping ball screens. And I've always been a very big proponent of trapping ball screens. That's kind of in the you know, the core of you know, who I was as a coach when, you know, I was at Webster, and that's like, that was a core thing that we did at Webster. Like, you want to set a ball screen, we're going to trap it. Now, you know, college basketball, different than high school basketball, different than pro basketball. You know, but in high school basketball, if you trap a high school point guard, you know, it's going to be able to create a lot of turnovers.
You're just trying to force, you know, the ball out of your hands at the college level. You're just trying to get the ball to somebody else.
Well, exactly. And I think that's one of the things, you know, particularly if you look at, you know, the way that TCU played and Auburn played, is if you force the ball out of the point guard's hands, and you're basically making somebody else make the plays. And And you know, if Miles isn't able to make those plays, you know, like, is this game another kind of one of those like easy 10 to 12 point wins that we had seen, you know, in previous games with you know, Missouri against like Texas A&M or South Carolina, where they just sort of were able to hold the other team at arm's length. I think at one point Missouri was up like 26-21, and it just sort of felt that they were in control of the game. You know, and then it's just like they just could never quite get that separation. Next thing you know, like, TCU's got it back within a bucket, and they struggle to get they go on a little run.
They struggle to string three stops together to open that gap to double digits, and maybe that takes a little bit out of wind out of TCU's sails at that point. If it's 10, and Missouri's shooting the way they are, and Tillman's getting to the rim, maybe. Which gets,
because they have, I mean, they had absolutely no answer for Jeremiah Tillman.
They were running three dudes.
He was an absolute monster, and they did everything they could to slow him down, and nothing worked.
Where I think I was a broken record after the game on set. I think TCU and Jamie Dixon, he should want to vomit after that game. They took their foot off the gas in the final 3:30. Once they got it to 11. They came down, they bled clock, they did some, you know, time-wasting spacing cuts, and then they'd go into an ISO, and it would be an attack, and it just felt like they have some veterans on that roster. RJ Nimbird's a veteran. Kevin Samuel's a veteran. Chuck O'Bannon is a junior, but he hasn't been like a prime. He hasn't been a key cog there. So they've really got just two key contributors. The rest are mostly underclassmen. And it felt like when Jamie Dixon went into four-minute offense there, it put them on the back foot, and they hadn't played that way all day. Missouri kept attacking. Missouri hit some jumpers. The four-point play happens, and now it's down to now you're in a one-possession ball game. And I don't know if TCU was quite ready to flip the switch back because they haven't played a lot in the past couple of weeks. It just felt, I just thought Jamie Dixon got way too conservative in the final 3:30. You're on the road. You haven't stopped Missouri all day. You haven't strung together any stops at all. Keep playing. Keep trying to score. Keep trying to put them in. Don't let up. Keep your foot on their throat. And that was my big takeaway. Credit to Missouri because they kept playing their asses off. But TCU just left the door open for them down the stretch. And I think you look back on the ride home and you go, did we maybe get too conservative? So that was the other kind of impression I had coming out of the game, coming out of the weekend.
So 11-3, top 20, still looking at, I think they're three seed line for the most part.
Three or four, depending on when the brackets were updated. The ones that were updated yesterday and today, a little bit more towards four and fives seeds, but the average seed has barely moved, so probably still across more recent brackets around a four.
Mm-hmm.
Last week didn't. It's so weird because people would say last week felt like things could have been dicey. They could have gone 0-2 last week, and they'd have like dropped to a six. Missouri's safely in the field right now. You know, they've got some insurance to play with. Not saying you want to use any of it right now. You never want to make a claim. You don't want to do that at all, but I don't think last week would have been as damaging in alone. I mean, you could have teed it up going into this week with Alabama on Saturday, but overall, 1-1, about where they were in KenPom, a little lower in the AP poll, still a four seed. And at this point, that's all you care about. You're just trying to tick off weeks till March without causing any more unnecessary harm. So don't feel like last week did much on that front, but we're continuing to see that there's angst, Samuel, about why is there this wide gap between where the AP voters have put Missouri and why Kim Pomin is and his A and his algorithm are so damned biased against the Tigers. Why? I want to know. I want to know why. I want a Zoom call of Ken updating them every day. I want transparency here. I want to know why he has a vendetta. Why he has an omerta? Why he's so against the Fair Tigers? Please explain to me he's rejiggering the math against my alma mater.
So I tend to think that like one of the reasons why Jesse Newell is kind of failing at his job is he's not looking at the AP poll as to what the AP poll is, which is resume based. And I think you and I both agree that it's at this point pretty inarguable that Missouri has one of the 25 best resumes in the country. The computers, however, do not really like Missouri all that much.
And I would agree with the computers.
And so, and that's the thing is, so for like, we're never going to convince Jesse Newell to vote a different way. Like he has made up his mind that he is going to vote this way. And like, this is the top 25 that he's going to release. He's going to release a top 25 that is based on like predictive metrics. And so I kind of think it's interesting that like you and I are very heavy into the predictive metrics. We like Ken Pom. We like Bart Torvik. All of these systems that are basically trying to tell you like what you can expect when two teams would play each other, you know, versus home and road, neutral site. Like that's why Ken Pom exists, to tell you like what your expectations could be. But that's not what the AP poll is. So why computers don't like Missouri is because Missouri, like at this point, if their defense was as good and as consistent as it's been kind of even in recent years, where I think they should be probably like a top 30, top 25 level defense, then I think the computers would like Missouri a whole lot more. But essentially, like, I'm trying to think about like the best way to phrase this. When you're looking at a long list of possessions that a team has played over the year, and at this point, I think Ken Pom has not completely phased out preseason predictions. It's really close. I ran some kind of rough numbers for people that were kind of paying attention, similar to what I did when I was sort of rebuffing, Newell's, objection to Missouri. The preseason rankings like don't always tell the full story because you don't really know how a team is going to perform in that year. You're going upon previous seasons of data, and that data can be influenced by all kinds of things. So now we have almost a full clear set of data for this year. And again, like I think that,
and to be clear, we don't know how Kim Pom is weighting prior data, and we don't know how he necessarily weights possessions, like the respective to possession volume.
Well, right.
So what we're talking about in aggregate here is essentially what you can do is you can calculate Missouri's raw efficiency, which is not that tough. You can you put it in the piece, you calculate number of possessions, you divide points by possessions, and that's how you get PPP. And you take the difference between offense and how many points Missouri scores per possession, how many they allow, and that's efficiency margin, and that's the raw total. And now you're going to try and weight that against Missouri's average opponent. So you will then go through, look at the average rating of the opponents they played, which I think you said today is like 71, and you will look at...
Yeah, so I basically took today's KenPom ratings of all of Missouri's teams, and it came up to like 71 point something, which if you look at KenPom right now, the 71st ranked team is North Carolina State.
And their adjusted efficiency margin is, I think, around like 12 or something. Like,
yeah, so it's 12.05.
So you would add Missouri's adjusted efficiency margin, which is 7 points per 100 possessions, to North Carolina's, because what you're going to do is that's what it would be against, you know, if you were to weight it for who they've played, it'd be 19 points is their adjusted efficiency margin against, is basically what it would be if you adjust.
Right. So essentially, like, what I'm doing to try to figure out where, you know, KenPom's data is as far as, you know, preseason metrics or how much is still might be weighted in that is I took Mizzou's raw efficiency, which right now they're basically at 7 points per 100 possessions, you know, better than their opponents. So the raw efficiency on offense is 1.05. points per possession.
0.98 is what they're allowed per possession.
Yeah, and they're allowing 0.98. So basically all the points that they've scored, number of possessions they've had, that's what they've averaged over the course of the entire season. Their average KenPom opponent is 71.35. Just have found the number here. So if you were to basically add seven to NC State's, you would end up at 29th in KenPom. So that would be 19.05. I just
if you look
lost my KenPom page. So 29th, it's basically like right behind Virginia Tech.
And what you can do if you want to compare where we are right now is you can look at what Missouri's KenPom, what their efficiency margin is right now on KenPom's page. Right now, it's 17.78. So the gap between, to get really technical, between efficiency margins is basically one. As that gap kind of shrinks, we begin to kind of see the weighting data move out. So Missouri's, again, there may also be some weighting that's happening in Ken's algorithms for various variables, for possessions, for tempo, things of that nature. But
So that's another thing that I kind of wanted to bring up is. And this is one thing that I sort of said over and over, like this is a pretty brutal way to kind of look at it and break it down. But one thing to keep in mind, like I don't necessarily know that KenPom does this with his algorithm, but if I were KenPom, I would probably factor this in. And that is, so not every game has the same number of possessions. So Missouri's like fewest possessions in a game this year was 62 versus Liberty. So even if you let's say, just for example, let's say that Missouri's most efficient offensive game happened in that low possession game, and then their least efficient offensive game happened in the game with the most possessions, which at this point would have been Auburn at 82. So if you were to, like, those 62 possessions that you played really efficient offense weren't necessarily helping you in the same way that a lower efficient game happened in over 82 possessions, because those number of possessions netted different results against different opponents and different pace. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what you're going to do is you're going to try and create an adjusted pace of which to weight everything off of, and then you'll adjust to that.
Precisely. So yeah. So those 62 possessions that you played against Liberty are going to weight on your offensive and defensive efficiency differently than
your 82%.
Yeah. Then your efficiency margin would have been against Auburn, you know,
which is all a way of saying what KenPom is trying to do is take everything that's happened, put it in. And we tried to explain it in a very straightforward way. I don't know how good of a job we've all done.
Yeah.
But what KenPom is doing is he is taking your efficiency margins, adjusting it for the average team you've played, and then we'll weight it based on tempo, most likely. We'll weight various tempos differently, and then you can see those efficiency margins, and it will project how you should perform against different teams. So what Ken is doing is he's essentially taking all of Division I's possessions, putting them in a big vat, and weighting them against each other, and now you can get a predictive outcome. And that's handy for us because we can begin to look at it. It can be handy in this way, and this is where I differ with Jesse. I don't look at the top line number so much as I like to look at what's on a team's page. What are their four factors? What is the data telling us about this team and how it plays?
Right.
How does this team perform?
It's an application of the, you know, the data as opposed to a strict reading of the data.
Correct. And what I think happens here is if you go in and you like average each of these algorithms, which is a tempting thing to do, you have no clue how they differ, how different things are weighted out. It to me, averaging them doesn't make a lot of sense unless you're going to weight each of the algorithms that you're using, essentially. And I don't think most journalists, I was a journalist and I got through like basically stat two at Mizzou. I don't have the competency to weight them appropriately.
Right.
So what I think you do is you look at them and you say, and this is where I think what, to the credit of most reporters now, because I think if you look at how the polls move over time, as we get further into the season, anecdotally, they start to more closely resemble KenPom, or more closely resemble these kind of advanced metrics and these predictive analytics that we use. So I think it's a sign that a lot of writers and a lot of people covering the sport are looking at these things and sort of trying to really do what I just said, get under the hood and understand how these teams play. And I think that informs how they do their results-based polling. So if you were to go to somebody who's voted Missouri 15th or somebody who voted them 18th this week, if you were to ask them if they looked at KenPom, what they'd say probably, looking at the rankings in there, Missouri's beaten some good teams, but there's nothing that really jumps out on their page. Like, if you look at Missouri's KenPom page right now, they're 113th in effective field goal percentage, they're 153rd in turnover percentage, they're top 100 in rebounding, offensive rebounding, they're really good at drawing fouls, and they're really good at shooting two-pointers, but there's nothing on their page that jumps out as elite. Defensively, they don't force a lot of turnovers. They're kind of average keeping teams off the glass. They foul a lot defensively. They're 272nd in foul rate. They're good at two-point defense, and they run teams off the line pretty well.
Yeah.
But what you would say is that's a pretty good team. It's a top 40 team who's gotten some good results. So we have to acknowledge that, yes, they've beaten some good teams, and we can't ignore that. They have not taken any bad losses. They've lost to Tennessee, top 20 team. Mississippi State on the road, you can talk about that as a bad loss. They're top 75 in KenPom. Not the worst loss. That's a quad 2 loss, even if you use net rating. And Auburn's going to, if they continue at this pace, is going to have moved up 35 spots in 3 weeks with Sharif Cooper. It's an entirely different basketball team.
That's just nuts.
Then it's nuts, but point being, I think you can say Missouri is not a dominant team. They're a team that on the right day can beat an Illinois, can beat an Oregon, can beat a Tennessee. But if, as we've seen, if jump shooting goes into a hole and dies, they're vulnerable. If they get a matchup against a team like TCU or Auburn where there's an especially dynamic on-ball creator that can sort of chew up Missouri's gap-based defense, and Missouri's not going to trap them, they can be in trouble. You can acknowledge that Missouri is a flawed team while recognizing that the performance they've put together merits inclusion in the AP poll.
Right.
And that's really where we are. And I get frustrated. What frustrates me is when people say these predictive metrics are wrong, they're biased. They're not. What, if you look at KenPom, and my understanding, he doesn't do a very good job explaining it. He has a category called luck, which to me is basically, the way I read it, a measure of variance. Like, if we have two teams that meet each other and we have a predicted margin of victory and it's off by a wide margin. It influences this variable, and the teams with the biggest variance have luck.
Right.
We call it luck because it's a wide, their outcomes kind of skew. Missouri's 10th in luck, which tells you that, you know, Missouri's won five quad one games, and they've also gotten the absolute crap kicked out of by Tennessee and Mississippi State by margins that were 14, 15 points wider than they should have been. So that tells you Missouri's a team that when it's in the right place, when it's heads on straight, it can be a really, really good team. But, you know, you're kind of dependent on the whims and who shows up that day. I think both those things can be true. And where I agree with Jesse's point is we should use these metrics. We should take them seriously to evaluate the quality of the team that's playing. But I disagree with him when he says that the job of the AP poll and his job is to evaluate quality programs. No, the AP poll, like you said, is to reflect in part the games that have happened.
Right.
Results that have happened. You can disagree that Missouri's a top 10 team. When Missouri was voted 12th last week, even I thought that was a little high. When people were saying they should have been a top 10 team, I even kind of blanched at that.
Yeah.
But there's five quad one wins. If you're going to make the argument, fine. But to just say I've averaged three analytic models and just three straight top line numbers, and it tells me that Missouri's not a top 25 team, like you Jesse's smart. I follow Jesse. Jesse tweets great stuff about like the Spain actions that Bill Self's running on offense. He does great stuff. And then to like abdicate and say, I just average these metrics. You're smart. You ask good questions. You write stuff that most of the time I'm interested in reading. Why would you now suddenly say, I'm gonna offload this to, you know, four guys who run websites? Use their models. They're smarter than all of us. They built the entire websites based on this, but you're free to have your own opinion or to respect the results that happen on the floor. So it's hard for me to get upset either way, because I feel there's Mizzou fans who are at one end of the extreme and there's Jesse who's at the other, and it's just much more nuanced than that.
Well, another thing that I'd like to kind of point out is, you know, while Missouri's resume is worthy of a top 25 ranking, their opponents aren't really, like, the teams that Missouri has beaten are not really doing Mizzou a whole lot of favors.
Average opponent ranking is down five spots since you last did it. It was 66 when you did the piece. It's down to 71.
Right. You know, and that's while they're in conference. So the only team that has really kind of stuck it out is Illinois. And we've seen Illinois, you know, provide a wide variety of performances. You know, they're capable of, you know, basically cracking down and beating Iowa without, you know, much fanfare. But, you know, they're also just capable of, you know, losing to, you know, Maryland at home. And, you know, Maryland is certainly, you know, lower in KenPom than Missouri. Oregon is another team that, you know, Oregon lost at home to Oregon State. You know, I thought Liberty was kind of trending the right way. They've been okay. Tennessee was top 10 in KenPom. They're now down to 15. Mississippi State has increased. Texas A&M has gotten worse. South Carolina has gotten worse. So, Auburn has jumped. So, you know, like that is going to help. But my point is basically that, you know, while those wins in real time were great, it also matters what those teams do after that. And some of those wins have lost a little luster, you know, because of subsequent performances from those teams. Like after Missouri beat Arkansas, I mean, Arkansas was top 30. I think they're the 30th. They've recovered a bit. But after Missouri beat them, that was Arkansas's first loss, and they went on to lose like four or five games. So, you know, I think like that's another thing with the metrics and why the computers, quote, don't like Missouri, it's because when you...
The teams they're beating may not be as good as you thought they
were. Right, and, like, you have to factor in each and every possession that is happening in Division I basketball. And so, Wichita State being better than they were expected is good, but they're only slightly better than expected and not, like, a lot better than expected. So, all that kind of plays a role. That being said, we are running a little low on time. Do you want to pivot and talk about Kentucky at all?
It's a bad Kentucky team, but they're an interesting Kentucky team too. To me, at least, they're interesting because this is close to being one of Cal's better defensive teams he's had in Lexington. We can talk about how much the circumstances of this season influence that, because I also think it matters and it has bearing on just how atrocious they've been offensively. But I think you put it best today. This is a team that still has enough raw blue blood talent on it that it can stumble in. If it stumbles into a night of offensive proficiency, the results can go poorly for you.
I mean, they beat LSU pretty handily. And, I mean, LSU has not been as good as I think a lot of people kind of thought they would be.
I think a lot of people thought they'd actually care about defense. They don't.
I mean, you and I didn't think that they would care about defense. I don't think we quite expected them to be as bad defensively as they've been.
To me, Kentucky's found its model. They're going to grind the pace down. They're going to try and defend as hard as they can. They're going to hope Dante E. Allen is knocking down jumpers. They're going to hope that Olivier Saar's face-up game in and around the block is working, and that they can cobble together something. Maybe Davion Mintz has a good game. Maybe Brandon Boston has a better shooting out of it. I mean, that kid is trying to work through a completely revamped jumper in a shortened off season and a screwed up regular season. He hasn't looked good at all.
He's still, when he takes the floor, yeah, he's almost always the most talented
guy. I just don't know what they have offensively.
As I always say, progress is rarely ever completely linear, particularly with basketball players. And Boston, is a guy who looks like he's kind of figuring it out, and then he takes a step back, and he looks like he's figuring it out, and he takes a step back. So I think this is a game that can be dangerous for Missouri, because there's still talent on that Kentucky roster, and Lord knows, all the issues that Missouri had around the rim, against Auburn with these athletic shot blockers.
If you haven't watched Isaiah Jackson,
he still provides a lot of that.
God, he's fun to watch.
He's fun to watch, isn't he? He's like 6'9", 6'10".
When Missouri was recruiting some guys for his
absolute pogo sticks for legs.
Watched him back-to-back years when they came here for the EYB element. That kid's timing off the floor and the space and ground he can cover is absurd. His recovery speed is amazing. His timing, his sense of where he is, needs to be rotating from the help side is just innate. He can wipe it out around the room. He's not built like a linebacker like Eve Pons is, but both of them just have innate sense of space, time, and how to recover back. He can wipe you out around the rim, and that they need that because Olivier Saar is not. I think that's the other thing that intrigues me about this team is Olivier Saar is not at all the kind of Kentucky big that I'm used to. He's way more finesse. Then I wasn't watching Wake Forest games in droves last year, I know, shocker, right?
What?
But to watch him now is to see a guy who he catches in the post, his first instinct is to reverse pivot into a face-up. And I'm not sure if he's not really either a guy to, like, Kentucky the last couple years has been, if we can't get anything off dribble drive, we're going to go high pick and roll, and we're just going to chuck lobs to the rim, and we're going to send PJ Washington, Nick Richards, we're going to send somebody up after it. That is not Olivier Saar. Isaiah Jackson, still trying to figure it out. But one good night, and they stumble into it, and they can be problematic. So that's what's interesting to me is, I know they're going to defend, I know they're going to grind the pace, but are they going to stumble into a good offensive night? Because they've got raw talent on the roster. The Alabama game, though, is before last week, dented some optimism. A lot of people were pointing to that game. I still think that's going to be really, really, really fascinating because it's coaches who have two clearly contrasting views on how you play the game of basketball, build their rosters accordingly, and I always like those matchups. How Nate Oates wants to play and how Konzo Martin wants to play, even after Konzo's adapted, to me are just fascinating contrasts, and I think that's going to. And the stakes are there. If Missouri wants to stay anywhere in the chase pack for top two or three finish, they have to get a result there. So that's probably more interest to me is what happens on Saturday.
Well, you know, it is interesting. So, you know, I do think it's difficult to sort of project what, you know, Kentucky is going to come out and play like. If there's a year where you should beat Kentucky, it's certainly this year. You know, but that matchup against Alabama is one where, you know, I'm looking at, you know, Missouri last year and how they played Alabama. And I mean, they made Alabama quit in that last game. You know, a team that, you know, I think you and I were both a little disappointed with how, you know, the Tide looked throughout most conference play. I think at one point they were like, they had a decent run. They kind of stumbled down the back end. They really didn't play very well away from home. That's what it was. They were, so looking at their schedule last year, they were 8-8. Coming off a home win against South Carolina, 16-13, probably still in kind of the discussion for an NCAA tournament bid. And then they lost to Vanderbilt at home. And came on the road to Missouri. And I don't know, Missouri was playing pretty well down the stretch. They had the Barcelona thing working with Xavier and Drew. And Missouri won by 19 points. This is obviously a very, very different Alabama team. They're eighth in KenPom right now. I think a lot of that kind of comes from, their ability to kind of win some of the games that they won through their little 10-game win streak. I still think this is an offense that you can kind of slow them down a little bit. If they're having an off night shooting, obviously it can make things dicey for them. The thing that I'm probably the most impressed with Alabama this year is their approach to defense. They seem far more engaged, defensively than they were last year. And really, in like probably the last couple of years,
part of that may be personnel too. Part of that may be the fact that, you know, Bolden is gone. Kyra Lewis is great offensively, but still kind of light, you know, just on the defensive end there. I think Alex Reese, for, you know, people might question his shooting, different than Galen Smith. I think they've gotten personnel that fits a little bit better. You know, we were critical of.
Well, and Reese also, yeah, I think Reese also is a guy who, has embraced his role a little bit more this year. He's much more like, I mean, he is willing to kind of take that, you know, that 3-point jumper, but he's a lot more willing to sort of be the guy who's the five who can take the other center off the dribble a little bit and kind of create that space. And I think that's helped them a little bit.
But yeah, I think that
obviously, like, John Petty has been Unbelievably good. And he's a guy who you and I both liked a lot. I don't know that I really ever saw him taking quite the step that
he's taking
this year.
He's shooting the ball a little bit worse, but I think I do think that merits things, but I think the defense is better, and if you watch them, I think what they're really good at doing is being opportunistic with on-ball pressure, but they still kind of want to pack it up. They still kind of want to they want to keep you out of gaps, and I think they've gotten better at that and mixing, you know, being able to force some live ball turnovers to run. I think they're better at that than they were a year ago. They found a better balance. But I think the one thing that's helped them, oddly enough, is they've moved Jaden Shackelford almost over to point guard. Because last year, because of how Lewis played, he was so good in ball screens. I think they had to kind of compromise a little bit for him to fit him some more. This year, they've got Jaden Shackelford. They're almost exclusively like kind of coming down with that Houston Rocket style spacing, and they're playing to dribble drive motion off of it. And Jaden Shackelford fits that because he can attack a closeout and still hit jumpers. And John Petty is good because I think people think of him as just a spot up shooter. He's shooting 35%, which is down from last year. But if you watch Petty, Petty can drive it a little bit. He can cut. He can create off the bounce for himself. And then they've got Josh Primo, who's not playing well in transition, but he's a long athletic dude who's shooting the hell out of the ball in the half court. And Herb Jones is playing like an offensive revelation. I didn't think Herb Jones would ever be this good. He's knocking down the occasional spot up. He's able to make some plays in transition. And he's just that guy who will still find ways to create offense for himself in the half court off rebounds and cutting. So I think they've just got a better guard mix that understands what they want to do, and they play to it a little bit more. But I do agree with you that if they don't shoot the ball well, life gets tough for them. They're 66th in half-court efficiency. They're 11th nationally in jump shooting. And they're only 282nd in finishing around the rim. And they're not good in pick and rolls. If jumpers aren't going, the well dries up for them pretty quickly. So the question is really, are they going to bury you? Because what they want to do is they want you to force the hard closeout, and then they're going to attack you. So I think it's just going to be fascinating how Missouri defends that this year, because I think they've got personnel that's more bought in and fits what they want to do. But a bad shooting night and it opens the door for a team like Missouri. So it's just going to be fascinating to watch how that stylistic contrast plays out.
Well, and also like the way that Missouri wants to play, which is similar as far as kind of spreading teams out and kind of attacking the rim, and again, like it kind of comes down to the officials and what kind of whistle, they're going to have. Alabama's not a team that really puts a ton of pressure on you to, as far as getting to the line and shooting a lot of free throws. I think they're a team that, they do want to drive and they do want to take shots around the rim, but they're not necessarily hunting contact the way that Missouri does sometimes. And if I think the key for me is if Missouri is able to, to generate a lot of free throws. And if they are, then I think they're going to be able to kind of take some of the pressure off their own offense for what, Alabama is going to try to do defensively and whether or not, they make jumpers. Obviously, if Alabama comes in and hits half their jumpers like they have against Arkansas or against LSU, it's going to be a long night.
They're going to have to get back and get organized quickly defensively, because Alabama will make you play long possessions. They have no problem sitting down and making and guarding and making you play out a long possession. But they're third nationally in possession length. I mean, they want to come down and score quickly. They are, Nate Oates has said at Buffalo, and he has said here, if you are open in rhythm, and we have, especially if they get a drive and a kick off of paint touch and on their break, he's going to let it go. So you've got to sprint to the rim almost, but then you've got to have guys who are able to get back and identify shooters. So I think Missouri's transition defense, especially off misses, is going to be important because Bama's not going to hold it or walk it. They're going to come down, and the ability for Missouri to match up, you know, Missouri's a team that wants to come down. They want to stop. They want to do good transition defense, match up, then force you to play, and they want to get into gaps. It's going to be fascinating what Missouri does in the first, like, 7 seconds of an Alabama possession. Can they come down, get organized, get matched up, and really just force Alabama to go into some more dribble drive motion stuff or just make them play out of a half-court possession? Because I think Missouri can function that way because Bama's not going to look to target them in ball screens. I think Missouri can do enough in rotation and they're sound enough maybe to shrink some gaps, but that assumes they win the race down floor and don't give up and just don't get bombed away from the perimeter. So I think that's where, to me, I'm watching and what I'm going to be interested in seeing. If you can't tell, we're way more interested in Alabama than we are in Kentucky.
I don't want to discount Kentucky because, I mean, obviously, you know, they're still capable, and if they have a good offensive night, it's difficult because they're talented. They haven't had a lot of good offensive nights this year, and that's why they're 5-10. But they're 5-10, and they're still, you know, like decent KenPom rating, so. You certainly hope that you get bad offense Kentucky and then you can move on and hope for the best against Alabama. So as far as you and me, we'll be back next week. There is National Signing Day for football. Matt, why do they have two of these things? It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it's the dumbest thing that you have a National Signing Day. And then you have another National Signing Day.
Just split the difference and put it in December.
I don't really care when you put it. I'm actually a favor of like, you know, banning the National Letter of Intent. I think we should just do a grant of aid and then call it a day. You have guys, you know, if they want to have a little signing ceremony, they can sign their grant of aid. Like, that's all it is. Then you just show up to campus when you're ready to show up. But yeah, so that's happening Wednesday. I think BK and Nate are going to record again this week, so they'll actually probably have some reactions to whatever happens. I don't know that we really expect Missouri to be all that active. But you and I will be back to review the week that was with Kentucky and Alabama, and looking ahead again to. I mean, we're all kind of hoping that these games happen. Right now, The Missouri game, for anybody that didn't see the news today, Missouri game got moved from Tuesday night to Wednesday night because Kentucky is coming off a little COVID pause. Sounds like all their players, the important folks are able to resume practice. So they're resuming practice, I think, today, and they're going to come to Columbia, Missouri for a basketball game on Wednesday, which is good for us. We get a night to just sort of sit and around and not do anything tomorrow. Then the following week after Kentucky and Alabama, Missouri will travel to Ole Miss, and then they get a return trip to Arkansas, or return trip from Arkansas as the Hogs will come back to Como for the Rally for Ryan game. So be on the lookout. Probably this week I'll post another little fundraiser that we'll have for the Rally for Ryan game. It will be pretty similar to last year, where I think we had like a straight donation thing. You could use the escalator clause, and then, you know, also add donations for specific, you know, statistics being hit, like number of three-pointers made, all that kind of stuff. So it should be interesting. Stay tuned for that. Yeah, anything else for you want to say, Matt, before we get out of here?
No, I think we touched every topic that needed to be discussed. And thank you for listening to our ramblings about statistical models.
I'm pretty sure that, you know, Mitch could probably cut that entire segment and nobody would be the wiser. But it felt good to kind of get some of that off my chest anyways. Matt, we'll be back next week. Make sure you subscribe, follow Matt on Twitter, follow me on Twitter if you're so inclined. All hate mail goes to Mitch. And we'll be back next week with more Dive Cuts. And until then, thanks for tuning in.